You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Last year, renowned Republican political strategist, commentator, and ad maker Rick Wilson broke with his party when he offered a scathing critique of President Donald Trump in his number one bestseller, Everything Trump Touches Dies, A Republican Strategist Gets Real About the Worst President Ever. Now he's taking it one step further and enraging some of his old colleagues in the GOP by writing a detailed playbook for how Democrats can defeat Trump in 2020. The book is called Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves. And today, Rick Wilson returns to the show to warn the Democratic candidates that this election is not about policy, but a simple referendum on the disastrous presidency of Donald Trump. And if they think it's going to be a cakewalk, think again. Rick warns that Dems need to prepare for a knockdown, drag-out bar fight. He also says that this race will be settled in 15 states, and Democrats need to focus on winning in the Electoral College instead of taking comfort in Trump's poor poll numbers. Rick suggests that they shouldn't shy away from hitting Trump on his biggest strength, the economy. He advises how to use Trump's impeachment against him, and even says Trump's family is fair game this time around. Plus, we talk about the various grifters and crooks in Trump's orbit, including Rick's old boss, Rudy Giuliani. Coming up with Rick Wilson in just a moment. Rick Wilson is a renowned Republican political strategist, writer, speaker, commentator, and ad maker. He is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Everything Trump Touches Dies, and now he's out with a playbook for how Democrats can beat Trump in 2020. It's titled Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves. Rick Wilson, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Like I mentioned in the intro, you are doing a playbook from a Republican strategist who's been in the game forever.
Yep.
For Democrats on how to beat a Republican president. I have to wonder, what are your fellow Republican operatives saying about you helping the opposition here?
Mostly they're dreaming about me spending time in Gitmo. They're not really happy about it. I've had some very nasty notes the last few days, including from a guy that I worked with a long time who has freely admitted to me how much he hates Donald Trump in private.
Yeah.
But in public, he's a lobbyist and he has to play the game. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, I could never speak to you again, you asshole. I can't believe you wrote this bar. I'm like, that's exactly the response I was hoping for.
Yeah. It's funny. I have encountered so many Republican operatives and veterans of other administrations, people who work on Fox News, conservative personalities, and so often when the mics are off, they tell me what they really think about Donald Trump.
Right.
And I'm like, why aren't you speaking up? We need more Republicans saying these things.
It's, you know, the first book, my first book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, I had a lot of stories from members of Congress who would call me and just freak out every day. Mm-hmm. And I've those guys, a lot of them were wiped out in 2018 because they couldn't pretend enough to like Trump. And so in this new era, if you're not a worshiper of Donald Trump, the Republican ecosystem now rejects you and throws you out of the body.
Yeah.
Look, in that regard, being an apostate and being a rebel now, being out in the world without having to sell my soul every day is great. I'm happy with where I'm at. Mm. And look, Running Against the Devil is a book that is basically two big parts. The first part is a warning about if you think it's bad now, Trump's second term can be so much more apocalyptically terrible.
Right.
It can be so much worse. And Democrats who think this is going to be an easy race or a race where they don't have to do the work will fall victim to the same thing that Hillary Clinton had happened to her, which is they'll wake up on November 4th and say, oh, dear God, how did we lose Florida? How did we lose Wisconsin again? How did we lose Arizona? What the hell happened? And this book is a warning that complacency or doing a campaign based on what you want it to be versus what it must be is a deadly trap. And for 30 years, Republicans had this long march through the country, and we won small races at first and then bigger races and then bigger races. And slowly but surely, we took over 38 state legislatures.
Right, right.
And I was along for a lot of that trip. I helped build a lot of the systems and design a lot of the methods we used over 30 years of taking apart Democratic core constituencies and stealing them. And I didn't even have to steal them forever. I could just borrow them sometimes. I didn't have to pick any particular group that I was going to permanently try to convert. I would just pick out who I needed in that election. So if I'm in Wisconsin and you're running a statewide operation in Wisconsin, I know something about male Democratic men in rural Wisconsin. They disagree with the Democratic Party, even if they're Democrats.
Huh.
They disagree with the Democratic Party on things like guns. I go into Ohio and I look at Catholic Democrats and I ID Catholic Democrats. I go, okay, we're going to talk about abortion in this place because these people are not comfortable with the Democratic Party's national position on it. They're Democratic voters on all these other issues, but we would find a way to go in and cherry pick and basically take a classic like Chinese menu approach, one from column A and one from column B and one from column C, and build these coalitions and build these campaigns that were able to short circuit what would ordinarily be Democratic voter behavior.
So you've been exploiting these fractures for years.
Yeah, because I can do math and I understand people. and I say that facetiously, but look, our campaigns on the Republican side, until the era of Donald Trump, which is a whole separate sort of phenomenon we got to talk about, but these down-ballot races in the Senate and the House and for the Democratic nomination and for the Democrats running against him, they need to be driven by data, not by inclination and ideology. They need to be driven by polling and focus groups and the voter data file and how they're getting their A/B testing back from social media on various messages, because they cannot run on what they think they want. If they run a campaign based on healthcare and climate change policy papers, they will lose a spectacular wipeout. Voters really don't make their choices based on that.
Yeah, I mean, if I hear the Green New Deal one more time in the Democratic debate, I think I'm going to lose my mind.
And here's the thing. Every policy the Democrats put out is an opportunity for guys like me to turn that policy into a nightmare. You put out a 600-page policy paper, and I will put my nerds to work, because I'm not going to read a 600-page policy paper, by the way. And no other American is either.
Yeah.
I've got highly trained geeks who do this.
Yeah. You're going to find something that can be used as a cudgel, huh?
And there will be five or six things in that 600-page document that will make it into an attack ad. And the thing you think sounds great, Medicare for All. We're going to, Well, you know what Medicare for All turns into in the ad? If you're a union worker here in Wisconsin, the Medicare for All plan means you lose your private health insurance. We negotiated hard. Our union backed us on it, and now they want to take it away. And you think that ad is over the top or overdrawn. It's not even close. These things will be fodder for a million ads. Arguing about policy and elections never works. People vote on personality. They vote on connection. They vote on things that are so macro that reducing them into a policy plan is entirely counterproductive. Mm. Look, I say this a lot. Donald Trump's policy fit on a trucker hat.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, So did Barack Obama's.
Mm-hmm.
Hope and Change.
Right.
It fit on
right.
a poster.
Right.
It was not. Barack Obama did not go out every day and say things like Elizabeth Warren does. On page 411, paragraph yeah. 6, footnote 4 of my healthcare reimbursement adjustment scheme, no one does that. And people in the voting pool don't believe that. Most mm-hmm. voters make up their mind very late. About 65% of the people who are going to make a vote, who are undecided in a big election, they'll decide in the last 2 to 3 weeks of the campaign. They're not reading policy papers. They're making a gut check decision. And so the Democrats have to get a candidate this time. And I work very hard in the book not to try to pick their candidate. But they've got to do a gut check of what's working as a referendum against Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
not what kind of policy proposals are going to move voters, because they don't.
Yeah, you're saying here, instead of getting bogged down on policy, you need to make this referendum on Donald Trump over the past 3 years. But, you know, isn't that pretty much what Hillary did? I mean, wasn't her whole campaign, at least I'm not Donald Trump?
Well, the problem with Hillary's campaign is they had a presumption of victory.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a deadly, deadly cancer that eats a campaign alive once it gets in your head. Mm-hmm. Once you start thinking, oh, we're going to pick out curtains and decide who gets what office, you expose yourself to enormous risk. So they took mm-hmm. their foot off the pedal in October. They thought that Donald Trump, even though the Comey thing was kind of a, you know, an irritation, they thought Donald Trump was going to lose and lose spectacularly.
Right.
So they stopped spending money in Ohio and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Arizona and Florida and other places. They violated one of the two key rules in a campaign. The first rule is there's only one resource you can never get back in a campaign, and that's time.
Mm-hmm.
You can raise more money. You can run more ads. You can hire more people. You can knock more doors. You can't get a single lost day back. Hmm. So they skated after the convention, thinking that Trump had imploded, that pussy grabbing and everything else had ended the campaign. The Republican rebellion was in full vocal swing in the campaign, and they presumed victory. So never presuming victory is a fatal flaw.
Yeah.
But wasting that time is a fatal flaw. The other thing is, when you stop going to the states that are on the Electoral College target list and start wasting your time in states where the election is already over, look, I know how California is going to vote.
Sure.
I know how Mississippi is going to vote. There are states, and probably about 35 of them, where, and as much as people hate it, as much as people despise the Electoral College, tough shit. It's the rule. That's yeah. how we do elections for president in this country. If you want to change it someday, give it a shot. Amending the Constitution, super easy. Try it anytime. Yeah, fun. but they're not going to overturn it. There's no law that's going to overturn it. There's no state compact that's going to mm-hmm. overturn it. It will be fought in the Electoral College. So the Democrats have got to go out and run messages and themes and have a candidate who can work in the Rust Belt states that flipped to Trump,
mm-hmm.
in Florida, in North Carolina, in Arizona, and a handful of other places, you know, New Hampshire, Maine, a handful of these other places where you've got to have a candidate who will not scare them off, who can bring that referendum in that case against Trump, and who is effective as a party leader to try to unify a party that saw a big drop off. Another thing Hillary did very, very wrong, they presumed African-American turnout would remain as robust as it was for both Bill Clinton and for Barack Obama.
Right.
Boy, was that a bad call. So you've got to have that candidate be able to do those things, especially in these states that are not as woke
mm-hmm.
and as far left.
Right.
And you know, I've had a lot of progressive friends who say, well, if we just turn up enough progressive energy, I'm like, if Donald Trump hasn't sufficiently excited the Democratic base at this point, I don't know who will.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they will fight till the last dog dies to go after Trump. So you've got the luxury of then being able to talk to people who are not super woke, of getting those white male rural Democrats who voted for Donald Trump and suburban Democrats in the Rust Belt states particularly, to come home.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an opportunity there. It's a narrow path. This is not easy for the Democrats. This is
sure.
not going to be an easy election.
Yeah, but I see what you're saying about Hillary, and I feel like I see a lot of that same cockiness already, because my impression is that Democrats are looking at Trump's poll numbers and operating on this assumption that anyone can run against him and win. No. And in fact, maybe I almost feel like they see this as their big moment to run the liberal progressive platform that they always wanted to run, but they couldn't when they had a more traditional, sane GOP candidate like McCain or Romney on the other side.
Look, I've said this to Democrats until I'm blue in the face. I'm like, you guys always want to know what the secret sauce is. It's not gerrymandering or voter suppression or any of those other things. Those are excuses. Those things may exist in some measure, but they're more excuses than reasons. The reason Republicans beat Democrats is they exploit cultural disconnects between the Democratic national top-level policy positions and the local and state characteristics of their voters in places where they, you know, until Trump came along, this long march we'd had, you know, 2,000 seats over 25 years and 1,000 during Barack Obama. Now, since Trump came along, Republicans have lost 650 of those. So good job, Donald. So much winning. But all those seats that we took from them, we did it by connecting better with voters and not not saying to them, you have to follow every single item on our ideological checklist. We just want to talk to you about this. But instead, and I mentioned it here in a focus group, this guy in a focus group I was in, mid-50s, early 60s, I guess, and he says, you know, I'm terrified that I'm going to use the wrong pronoun and I'm going to get fired. Because I don't know the rules. I don't understand the rules. And the rules are always changing, and I don't get it. He was a, and if I'm not mistaken, he was a Bush, Obama, Trump voter. Okay? So you do that math. But he didn't, he lives in this fear of like the politically correct thing that's out there, the wokeness police. And I promise you, other guys like me who are working for Trump have found that too. And that's why they're always playing these cultural aggrievement games, the war on Christmas, Sharia law, Mexican caravans are coming to kill you and put a taco truck on your street. You know, the combination of all those things. And they're playing to something that's out there. And it's not, some of it is racism and xenophobia, but some of it is just cultural and social uncertainty about a world that's changed very quickly and about a world that isn't what a guy who works in a, you know, a guy who does IT at a auto parts factory in Wisconsin is not keeping up with what is the appropriate gender surnames. You know, he doesn't know from her, and he doesn't know how to use those things, but they're afraid that the corporate culture is going to come and get them. And look, part of that is generated by this agitprop network at Fox, which is always telling them the bad liberals are coming to slay you.
So I guess Democrats really have to ask themselves if some of these smaller cultural issues are the hill that they want to die on.
Well, and I say that in the book. I mean, the culture war is where Democrats go to die. and they just you talk to them sometimes, and there's this moment where, and I've had this discussion a lot in writing this book in the last couple of years, where you say to them, "Hey, don't run on gun control in North Florida." And they say, but what about gun control in North Florida? And you say, don't run on gun control in North Florida. You'll lose North Florida. But South Florida, it's really popular. Okay, you want to win also North Florida, which is, you know, 40% of the vote. Do you want to win that or do you not? And this disconnect, these articles of faith in the progressive side. And again, and in the book, I'm not, and I say this explicitly in the book, I'm not telling you what policies of yours are right or wrong. Many of them are wrong.
You're not trying to turn Democrats into Republicans.
I'm not trying to make them moderates. I'm not trying to make them centrists. I'm not trying to make them Republicans. I'm just telling them if they run on certain issues in certain places, guys like me are going to take their lunch money.
Yeah, I guess it's easy for Democrats to be a little bit optimistic if you look at the polls. I mean, I don't think that I've seen Trump above 50% approval in 3 years. And yet last time, all the polls had Hillary beating Trump by a decent margin, and all the polls were proven wrong. Do polls matter anymore?
State polls matter. And one of the things that Hillary Clinton's team, And I had a piece of insider knowledge from this. Somebody told me the story from inside that world. Mm-hmm. They were getting worried about Wisconsin and Ohio late in the campaign. They were seeing the slippage, and they poured some money back in at the last minute. State polls were very accurate, and frankly, really? The national polls captured almost to the penny the split in the popular vote between Clinton and Trump.
Huh.
Guess what? National polls and $3.75 gets you a latte. National polls mean nothing in the end of the day. They're big, they're big sweeping barometers, mm-hmm. but you can't make a campaign decision based on them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you can't make a campaign decision based on even state polls. You've got to be running your own digital polling operation every night where you're making tens of thousands of calls in the course of a month into a state. It's not the 600 mm-hmm. sample thing anymore. You know, we've overcome the online polling and the robo polling problem by just throwing the more numbers at it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you would do a regular survey, you survey 600 people, you've got a good sample. Robo poll, you survey 1,000 people, you've got a sample.
Yeah.
So we sample 10,000 people or 20. You know, okay. Robo polling and VoIP polling is cheap now.
Yeah.
And we also have a lot of stuff online where we're watching, you know, who responds and who clicks on what message.
Mm-hmm.
Who's looking at, you know, you'll get a group of 1,000 voters you want to influence. And so 500 of them will get ad A and 500 will get ad B. And you A-B test. And if ad B works better, they get a lot more of ad B.
Mm-hmm.
And then you study ad B and ad B plus or ad B 2.0 and which one works. And you this algorithmic driving of messaging is something that Democrats – Republicans invented micro-targeting in 04 and maybe a little before. But Democrats invented this online targeting system. You working with Facebook in 08, the Republicans reverse engineered it. Okay, there were two groups that reverse engineered it.
Yeah, what happened? Because, yeah, I mean, the Obama had such a great digital operation.
Right,
and
you know what?
It's
Hillary
like they
Clinton's people
from
had,
under him.
Had a problem called not invented here.
Okay.
And they wanted to recreate it on their own. And, you know, there's a reason why most fighter airplanes look the same. There are certain design principles that work for fighter airplanes. They're skinny. They're pointy. They have big, big overpowered engines. Well, don't try to reinvent the classic problem in campaigns is you don't have the advantage of the tech industry. Mm-hmm. You can't do scale fast, fail fast.
Right.
You have to scale fast and not fail. And so the abandonment of that and the belief that you could basically muscle through it without a great digital operation is one of the great lessons of 2016.
Sure.
And if the Democrats, and I right now I fear that any of them have a good digital operation.
Hmm.
That is one of the things I talk about in here is the Democrats' campaigns are run very differently than Republican campaigns. For years, there were always this like, you know, friend of a friend, you got to bring in everybody from the loser's campaign into your campaign. Screw that. You need the tightest, smallest campaign operation you can manage in the management side so you can put as many people with boots on the ground and knocking doors and doing calls on the other. You want to make a very – their campaigns typically are very top-heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
Their campaign needs to be light at the top, heavy on the tech, heavy on the warm bodies because Trump's campaign is going to be very, very, very heavy on the tech. And very, 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 very heavy on the money.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have some advantages. Yeah. They're going to have to do a lot of smarter campaigning. And the campaigns have to be accountable.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. I have to say, though, I'm still amazed that Trump was able to win this election in spite of this monumentally shitty campaign team that he had. I mean, he had
a lot of help from the outside.
Grifters and wannabes
sure.
and washed-up GOP hacks like Manafort and Roger Stone.
Sure.
He had apparently no ground organization, very little discipline. Every week's a new dumpster fire. Can we expect a much better organization this time around?
Well, let me tell you one of the great advantages they had. Was that for 30 years, the Republican Party basically ran one long negative campaign against Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
She was a disliked figure because she had been beat up for so many years by the GOP. And she was also a terrible candidate, probably one of the worst candidates of a major party since Mike Dukakis.
Really?
She was a bad candidate. She did not perform well. I watched it. I watched the dial groups in focus groups. I watched her talk and watched them turn the dials down. Mm-hmm. And these were Democrats and independents. And they just never felt like she was being real with them. And look, she's got a lot of reasons for hurt and like all this built up defense mechanism in her life. I get it. But she was not a felicitous candidate. She was not a happy mm-hmm. warrior. She was not out there swinging for the fences every day and enjoying the great battle. The other thing that overcame a lot of Trump's problems was that for 15 years, NBC had Trump on its air on a very popular television show.
Sure.
And so voters out there, their image of Trump, unless they were from New York City, okay, their image of Trump was largely derived from The Apprentice. He's smart. He's a great negotiator. He knows people. He's a billionaire. He talks all these deals and all these ideas that he's, you know, that this image that they got that a screenwriter put down and Trump read off of a teleprompter is now president.
God. Yeah.
And so those two things played a very big role in 16. You mm-hmm. won't have that same level, but you will have Trump. Look, the clowns and the jokers are still around Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also a lot of folks in the Republican Party, guys like me, who are still there because they're ride or die with this guy. They don't have mm-hmm. an option.
Right.
There's no other third party. There's no other Republican candidate they can go to. So they're stuck. Mm-hmm. And if they want to make money, and Trump is going to spend a tremendous amount of money, they're going to stay. They're going to keep their mouth shut. They're going to play ball, and they're going to do what they're told to do.
Yeah. Now, give us a little bit of a preview of the Trump campaign in 2020. What's he going to be running on? What's the message? Sure. Can you see a strategy beginning to form?
The strategy that Trump will run on is very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with you. I'm the voice of the common man. I'm the voice of the silent majority. It is Richard Nixon's campaign that Roger Ailes designed in 1968. They are the brown people. They are coming to take your home, your job. They're going to replace you in society. The caravans are coming. They're violent criminals and rapists. The liberals want to take away your money, your freedom, your guns. And it is a base-only election for Trump. The advantage of that for Trump is that the electoral college states he has to play in, the base is almost big enough for him to do it.
Huh.
The downside for Democrats in those states, the electoral college states they have to win in, is their base is not quite big enough to do it. So they have to do a pull operation to get independent voters and to get Republican voters and get those Trump-Obama voters and to get suburban women who are drifting toward them, but they're not there yet, to bring them in. And a lot of those voters who've soured on Trump, they're not looking for a Democratic Trump. They're not looking for the revolution. They don't want – you know, the aristos taken to the guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
They're not there. They don't want to feel scared. They don't want to feel like this country is run by a cruel, capricious, and corrupt asshole. So that's why there's an argument to be made. And again, I'm trying not to pick the candidate for somebody who's more affable and more able to mm-hmm. talk to those folks in those states.
Mm-hmm.
That argues more for a Biden type, a Klobuchar type.
Okay.
Than it does for a Bernie type. And I say this in the book, I'm going to get my Twitter feed melted down as I do every damn day. Bernie Sanders will lose 44 or 45 states. He will get blown out so hard. It will be like Jeremy Corbyn mm-hmm. has destroyed the Labor Party in Britain. The Democrats will be in the wilderness for a generation if it's Bernie Sanders.
Okay. But what about all those Bernie bros who went to Trump in the general election?
Exactly.
Can that be counted on?
No. Here's the problem. Bernie bros are anarchists. They don't care. They want chaos.
Mm-hmm.
They want that sweet smell of gunpowder in the morning. They're not after a progressive revolution or any of that other stuff. They're anarchists.
Okay.
And Bernie took his ball and went home last time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the Hillary people know it. And Hillary took a pop at him today, or at least this week, basically saying nobody likes him for a reason. He's a career politician who hates everybody. And, you know, Bernie took his ball and went home. In 2016, he gave one or two speeches. Yay, Hillary. Oh, okay. I'm going to endorse her. Because the contract requires I endorse her, and now you're endorsed. I'm leaving. That's my Bernie imitation. That's about as far as I go. It's not terrible, it's but not the Larry millionaires Davids, and billionaires are attempting to steal this election from me.
Now, Trump's response to impeachment and the Mueller investigation, any criticism at all has usually been, well, just look at the economy. That was working for Bill Clinton in 96, barring a full-blown recession. Do you think that there are places where his strength can be turned into an Achilles heel?
There is an opportunity for that, and three things are out there in play. The reason he did a crash and burn on the trade deals and basically gave China and Mexico and Canada mm-hmm. everything they wanted was the economic damage in the Midwest and in the Rust Belt states was tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
We've basically paid about $100 billion in subsidies to farmers by borrowing that money from China to help pay for the economic damage that a trade war with China did to them, which is the most recursive dumbassery I've ever seen. But the economic bubble that we're in, look, for 8 years, so George Bush and Barack Obama both made a very consequential decision. George Bush to bail out the banks so that we wouldn't have a complete economic collapse. Barack Obama to continue the stimulus and the TARP program that kept those banks alive. And then to keep the Fed rolling this long injection of liquidity into the markets mm-hmm. at zero interest rates. Now, Donald Trump has browbeaten the Fed to keep that flow running. Even though we don't need it hypothetically, we also had a $2 trillion tax cut that primarily affected Wall Street and the hedge fund industry. And I know this because I know the guys who wrote the bill. I know the really? Guys who were sitting no in kidding. McConnell's office, the lobbyists who were in McConnell's office writing this on behalf of their clients in the hedge fund and the financial services industry. And so that has juiced Wall Street tremendously. Mm-hmm. They love it. It's fantastic. Yeah. We've also done $2 trillion of deficit spending. You know, we basically doubled the annual budget deficit. And so all the stimulus is in the economy right now. I'd be shocked if it wasn't doing what it's doing.
Sure.
But all sugar highs crash. All sugar highs end.
Right.
And there is a message to voters out in the country that the tip of the iceberg, at the very peak of the economic pyramid, they are, in fact, reaping 85% of the benefits of all this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people in the gig economy and the part-time economy, which is where the economy is growing the fastest, you know, they're not feeling economic security.
Mm-hmm.
They're still feeling very economically insecure.
True.
There's an argument to be made here for the Democrats. I know this is going to blow their minds. They can become a party that's much more driven by market capitalism in a genuine way than rather than the crony capitalism way that Trump is expressing it. Because
mm-hmm.
the country is still I know Democrats are going to need to sit down and get the smelling salts out. Basically market capitalist. People's ambition is still to do great in a job or a business and succeed and provide for their kids and their family and do great things with that.
Mm-hmm.
They still want to be rich by working for it. It is less resonant for them, well, as I jokingly like to say, to put the aristos in the tumbrils and take them to the guillotine. They're not looking for the socialist, you know, the socialist revolution. They're looking for a level playing field where work and opportunity go hand in hand.
Whatever happened to America's bullshit detector? Because, you know, when I think of these farmers and the steel workers and the coal workers who all got sold a bill of goods.
Nothing.
Why aren't they angry about being played for fools?
Well, we go back to what I said earlier. The Republicans are great at offsetting their economic interest
mm-hmm.
by getting into that cultural space.
Right.
Because you know what? Here's the thing. You got a guy in West Virginia. He sure as hell voted for Trump. And he did not. He voted for John McCain. And he voted for Mitt Romney. Okay. And he is getting his ass kicked economically. He is getting destroyed. His industry is dead. Coal mining is dead. It's still dead. Everything Trump touches dies, perfect example. No matter how many regulations Trump cuts, the coal industry is still dead. It's over. Those guys have nothing.
Yeah.
They got fucked by this guy.
Yeah.
But you know what? In the fall, Democrats are going to say at the national level, they're going to go, we want a full ban on all semi-automatic weapons. And that guy in West Virginia, no matter how bad he's been fucked economically, is going to go, screw you. Fuck off. No. And that guy in Western Pennsylvania and Southeastern Ohio and Northern Michigan and Western Michigan, everywhere in Michigan except the Detroit ring. Mm-hmm. And that guy in North Carolina, which is a winnable state for Democrats if they just don't step on their dicks, is going to say no. Or, and you can iterate that out. Go to Ohio. We're going to third term abortions. Yay. What a great idea. Only 13% of the country believes in third trimester abortion, no matter where you stand on the issue of choice. Okay. Only 13% of the country thinks that's a good thing. And yet you will have Democrats who will get trapped into it. Trump will bait them into it, and they'll be defending taxpayer funded third trimester abortions in Catholic southeastern and southwestern Ohio. What? Don't take all the bait.
Yeah.
Don't say everything on your mind. Don't tell people everything you think that your friends at the DSA want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Shut your mouth once in a while and show some campaign discipline.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I've had guys who literally wanted to destroy Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, Republicans, who literally believed that those things must be burned to the ground for free market economic purposes.
Wow.
And you know what I said to them? If you ever fucking say that in public, I will quit and I will embarrass you. Shut your mouth. Shut up. Stop talking. Do not say what is on your mind. So that's something I talk about in the book a lot, is you don't have to tell everybody everything all the time.
Mm-hmm.
TMI is a real thing.
Yeah. Now, the current group of candidates on the Democratic field, they seem to more or less be sticking to the Obama playbook of when they go low, we go high. Is
what
that going to work for them in this election?
Mistake.
Do they need to gloves off?
Ben, this is a bar fight. These are people who have never been in a scrap in their lives.
Right.
You got to go in here with a tire iron and a baseball bat. You cannot go into a fight with Donald Trump thinking, he will say something egregious and I will shame him. He will be so embarrassed he'll never do that again. Bullshit. Trump thrives on that. He loves that shit. He wants you to try to make him ashamed. He wants you to whine about it. He wants you to complain. You know, when Ted Cruz was getting beat up by Trump and Trump said, oh, your dad killed JFK and your wife is ugly. Ted Cruz's response was, first it was like, how dare you, sir?
Yeah.
You have offended my honor. And then it was, we're better than this. The party's better than this.
Right.
The correct response was, your wife's a mail order whore. Fuck you. Get back in their face twice as hard. Trump never gets punched in the face because no one has the guts to do it. They're afraid or they'll go in with one swing.
Yeah.
They'll go in with one punch.
Yeah.
Like poor Jeb. I love him to death. But he went in there like one joke about Trump, and then Trump proceeds to like whip his dick out and like screech and go, your dad. Rah, rah, rah. And poor Jeb's like poleaxe. He doesn't get it. He's like standing there with his head cut in two. And you can't swing at Trump once. Mm-hmm. Marco makes one joke about the hands, then gets scared off.
Yeah.
You've got to go in there and you've got to never stop hitting him. Once you start, you cannot stop. You've got to get into his shit. You've got to call him things that he hates. Call him fat. Call him stupid. Call him poor. They're all true. I am a happy warrior. I love fighting in politics. I love scrapping. It's great fun. And it's what the founders knew was going to happen. We were going to always have fights left and right, federalist and anti-federalist, conservative, whatever you want to phrase it. People who don't have fun in this lose.
Yeah.
And Trump actually enjoys what he does. He enjoys fucking with people.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have a guy who will break all the rules and violate all the standards and crack every norm we've ever had, and your hope is to shame him into good behavior, that's a fool's errand. You've got to be in the fight. You've got to fight like you mean it.
Now, does that mean that family's fair game? I mean, if Trump is going after Hunter Biden, is it season?
I've always, as a campaign rule, left minor children out of it.
Okay, so no attacking Barron.
Never said a word about Barron in any sarcastic way, except to tell people, stop talking about their kid. He's a minor child. Now, look. The minute he's 18 and gets involved in politics, fair game.
Okay.
Yeah, the Eric the wide gummed moron and Don Jr. and Ivanka and Jared, they're all. I mean, Jared's not really a family member, but it's all very close in that family. My theory, by the way, was always that Donald Trump wanted Jared to go to jail so he could comfort Ivanka properly.
oh my god!
But Their kids, absolutely fair game. Mm-hmm. And if it's wrong for Hunter Biden to get a job working for a Ukrainian company, is it wrong for Ivanka to get patents and trademarks from China while we're negotiating for a Chinese trade deal?
Mm-hmm.
Is it wrong for the Trump boys to be selling condos hand over fist to Saudi nationals?
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
So gloves are off. Everything is pretty much fair game. Mm-hmm. Anything goes this time around.
Look, this will not never rely on decency in this campaign.
Well, and I think that Democrats don't understand the lengths to which he will go in 2020 because they're assuming that his motives are pretty much the same as 2016, where, it was an exercise in vanity with no real consequences for Trump. But this time, winning is an existential imperative for him, because if he loses, it's not like he's going to go back to playing golf and hanging around Mar-a-Lago and chasing porn stars.
Right.
He knows that staying in the Oval Office may be the only thing standing between him and prison.
Correct. And this is one of the things that Trump's enablers are why they're so committed to winning this race.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know that if they can drag this out for 4 more years, they might escape prison time. But there are an awful lot of people around him who, when there's an actual attorney general who isn't just a factotum for the Trump family, and where there's an actual Department of Justice again, there's going to be some very big legal bills and some very bad outcomes. And as Paul Manafort has learned, Donald Trump will not save you from prison.
We're talking on the first day of the Senate impeachment trial, and in the book you actually cautioned Democrats against impeachment. But now that ship has sailed, how would you advise Democrats to play the Senate impeachment?
Yeah, look, and I wrote that chapter of the book and turned the manuscript in August of last year. Right, of course, and my publisher was like, absolutely no changes after this date. This is locked. We're in stone. It never can be changed until maybe we can do a paperback change later. I'm like, no, this Ukrainian thing. Oh, no, seriously, guys. No, I mean, really, really. And they were great about it, I got to say. They really were. We were able to still make our deadline. And, some very dedicated people worked some long weekend hours. But I had to basically recalibrate that chapter a little bit, because Ukraine was a very clearly impeachable, bright line, immediate offense with a simpler narrative structure than Russia.
Right.
A much simpler narrative and a provable narrative structure that led to a fact base.
Right.
That you could touch right now. Mm-hmm. That wasn't locked away in the vaults at the NSA or hidden away in Russia.
Yeah, but Trump's, he's fundraising off of impeachment
of course.
Now.
Oh,
he's using it to his advantage.
It's a
two-edged
sword.
How do they play this?
It's a two-edged sword. Right now, Americans increasingly believe Trump is corrupt. Why do we believe that? Because he tells us all the time he's corrupt. And he shows us all the time he's corrupt. In this case, he sought to extort another country by using American military aid in order to get a single personal domestic political benefit. This whole argument of Donald Trump, he's dedicated to fighting corruption. Yeah, that's like, I'm dedicated to fighting against the Popeye's fried chicken sandwich, okay? It's a battle I fight and lose constantly. So, this is an administration that, there's going to be accountability at some point, mostly for the people around him.
Mm-hmm.
But impeachment has stained him. It is also psychologically troubling him.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get to removal in the Oval.
Sure.
Or in the Senate. You're not going to pull him out of the Oval Office from the Senate. You're just not. You're not going to get to 2/3. It's something I said when I wrote the chapter, and I said on social media and on a million news shows, people who believe that he's going to be removed because he was impeached in the House need to read the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a little couple of extra steps there you got to go through. I just think that the increasing degree to which it marks Donald Trump as a self-serving criminal has a benefit. It has also opened up a whole bunch of other venues. I mean, the House needs, the minute Mitch McConnell kills the baby in its crib, they need to go back. The Intelligence Committee needs Lev Parnas in the docket the second they've got the bandwidth to do it. They need these other people in the docket the minute these other people they've got the bandwidth to cover it. And
Okay, so this, so, and there's some talk of that.
Depending
on how things play out in the Senate, that the House might reopen investigations and get witnesses back.
But
does that play into the narrative that Trump will pitch of, well, they couldn't do it in the Senate, so now it's just more of the same. They never give up. They couldn't do Russia, so they went to Ukraine.
You know, he's going to say that. He's going to say that regardless.
Yeah,
but no scandal with Trump ever gets better.
Mm-hmm.
You never, when you're digging through the new evidence that always comes out, you never go, well, that fully exonerates the president. My God, we were wrong all along. Yeah. You end up, in fact, with more data. I mean, think about the Ukraine thing as right now. It went from a perfect phone call with a transcript that was going to end the discussion the day the White House released their transcript.
Right.
And I had a reporter from a major paper say to me, well, the transcript seems pretty clear. It's a little bit of whatever, but every day gets worse. The only easy day was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in the Senate, this is a message for my friends in the Senate. You're defending Donald Trump with this Mitch McConnell plan to short-circuit impeachment. As more things come out, and they will come out, voters will not look at you as somebody who held a fair hearing in the Senate, a fair trial in the Senate, they'll look at you as a co-conspirator.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump relies on that a lot in the Republican Party. But he's going to defend himself on impeachment. But you know how much it bugs him. He hates it. He hates the fact that he's got this stain on him now.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I just have to ask, because I know that you go way back with Rudy Giuliani and advised his mayoral and Senate campaigns. Mm-hmm. What the hell happened to him? What's going on with that guy?
It is a tragedy that's playing out in front of us, and it's been a while since I talked to him, since like 16.
Yeah.
So, you know, the guy is, he is experiencing ETTD.
Mm-hmm.
All the symptoms are present. And the tragedy of Rudy is this. You know, when I went to work with him in 97, New York was at that inflection point where a couple of hard years of cleaning up the city and trying to turn the economy around, we're starting to pay off.
Yeah.
And there was a great optimism in the city and a great uplift.
Mm-hmm.
In all five boroughs, in every possible community, things were turning around.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy came out of that experience, and the coda to his mayor's race, or his career, sorry, the coda to his career as mayor was 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the election's still going on. Mike Bloomberg and Mark Green are fighting it out. Rudy finds himself drawn to this moment where he met these characteristics that those of us who'd worked with him had always known about. There's a good Rudy and a bad Rudy. The bad Rudy is snippy, can be impetuous, can be a bastard. The good Rudy, when the shit hits the fan, stands up.
Hmm.
And my analogy always was Batman. Rudy was Batman. You know, there were times you just hated the way he got the job done, and you didn't want to look at it too closely.
Uh-huh.
His methods were rough around the edges. But you wanted Batman when the world was on fire. And on 9/11, Rudy had a single moment of leadership that would have washed away a million sins.
Mm-hmm.
You would have named high schools after this guy.
Yeah.
We would have taught him as an example of leadership till the sun cooled.
Yeah, America's mayor.
America's mayor. And, you know, he ran for president in 2008. It didn't work. It didn't, you know, but it didn't kill him. It didn't. Yeah. He didn't leave the race humiliated and shamed.
Right.
It wasn't that bad.
But he took a big gamble.
It was a gamble.
And let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Is Bloomberg's campaign basically a repeat of Rudy 2008?
Yes. It's a recapitulation of it with more money.
Yeah. Well, will more money work?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
Because he's betting heavily on Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. He is betting very heavily. And, you know,
buying tons of ads.
We'll see how we've never been in that zone before. We'll see how it works.
Yeah.
But to finish with Rudy.
Sure.
Unfortunately, Trump is both corrupt and corrupting. And I think Rudy was at a point in his life where he wanted relevance and excitement and a swan song.
Mm-hmm.
And when Trump came calling, there was a thing about Trump. Even though Rudy, when my experience with Trump, and Rudy was never like a Trump like fanboy. It was always like, oh, yeah, give Donald a couple parking passes. It was never like, we're going to move heaven and earth for the guy.
Right, right. I mean, they were kind of casual social acquaintances.
Right. They were in the same sort of media pool, Page Six, gossip rags in New York. Yeah.
Right.
But I think when Trump came along, he saw a chance to play to the one conceit that Trump and Rudy really share, and that's that New Yorkers are a different, superior species to all other Americans. It didn't work. Trump has now shamed him. He will not be Trump's attorney. The idea that Rudy, the super lawyer, was going to have this revival under Trump is wrong.
Yeah.
And ETTD. And, you know, the irony, the painful, horrible irony, how did Rudy become mayor? By fighting when he was U.S. attorney in the Southern District, by putting scumbag criminals and corrupt politicians and money launderers and foreign organized crime in jail. Rudy now may go to jail because he helped a corrupt politician deal with foreign scumbags and money launderers. It's it's Greek in the arc of this tragedy. Yeah. It is a hermetically perfect tragedy playing out in front of us, and no one around Rudy, and everybody's tried to help him.
Wow. Yeah.
Everybody's tried to help him who can reach him, and he won't talk to anybody about it. And he's going to go down with this thing. He's going to burn, and Trump will leave him broke and indicted and destitute. And if he goes to prison, Trump won't help him.
Like you said, everything Trump touches burns.
When I came up with the everything Trump touches dies rule.
Or dies, yes.
I thought it was a sort of like a great line, a great book title. But now it's become like an iron law of American politics. And it's really a lesson with very few exceptions.
Definitely. Well, before we go, I just have to ask, would you consider working as a consultant for the Democratic nominee?
Well, right now I'm a co-founder of the Lincoln Project, which is a group of former Republicans and conservatives who have put together a super PAC. We're raising a significant amount of money right now. Not Mike Bloomberg money, but we're doing well. We've got a very strong response, both from the small dollar donor people and from major donors, including a couple Republicans out there.
Huh. And George, is that the one that George Conway is also involved in?
Yeah, it's Steve Schmidt, George Conway, myself, John Weaver, Reed Galen, Tara Sutmeyer. A whole bunch of people now have joined the throng, but the co-founders, the guys with the badge, as I like to say. We've had a very powerful response to this. We've started going after Trump's enablers in the Senate. Cory Gardner and Sue Collins are on deck right now. And they're not happy. But you know, the Liam Neeson joke's pretty tired now. But between us, we have a particular set of skills, and we're applying those skills right now to cause Donald Trump some trouble, because we all believe, you know, kidding aside, that he is a proximate threat to this country's future.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the very best of luck with
Thank
that.
Thank you so
Fingers
much, Ben.
Crossed.
Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. Again, the book is called "Running Against the Devil: A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves." Rick Wilson, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks again.
Thanks again to Rick Wilson for coming on the show. Order his book, Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Keep up with Rick at therickwilson.com or on Twitter at @TheRickWilson. And look for his regular column at thedailybeast.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.